Welcome to today's program titled, New Washington Non-Compete Law. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call. Devin, you may begin.
Good morning. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Devin Smith. I'm an employment attorney in Davis Wright Tremaine's Bellevue office.
And this is Matt Jodreski. I'm an employment and litigation attorney at Davis Wright's Seattle office.
Matt and I both regularly negotiate and litigate competitive departures, including breach of non-compete agreements. Matt and I have both been monitoring the developments with the new Washington non-compete law, and we are glad for the opportunity to share that with you guys today. We've structured the webinar pretty straightforwardly today. There are just four parts to the presentation. The first part we're going to go through is what we're calling the old world, and that is essentially everything from the past 90 years or so in Washington. The second piece is what we're calling the new world, and that's everything after January 1st, 2020, which is the effective date of the new non-compete law. And as we'll talk about as we go through the presentation today, nobody really knows what that looks like, but we're going to do our best to explain it. The third piece we're going to go through is common scenarios that we're seeing with our clients already. We've had many clients, dozens of clients already come to us and ask us to rework their non-competes, and we're happy to share some of those learnings with you, which is a good segue into the fourth piece we're going to go through, which is best practices and recommendations.
And I should add that there's a large group of us here at Davis Wright who do this kind of work. And not only that, but this work is really interesting to attorneys in our community kind of generally. So a lot of what we have thought through and put together not only comes from Devin and me, but from a lot of the smart attorneys we have here and even some of our clients and colleagues at other firms who have been discussing this issue on various groups and listservs and things. So let's talk about first what a non-compete what that life cycle looks like and how we end up in a position where we're analyzing enforceability. The first thing that happens is that you have an employee with a non-compete and they depart for a competitor. And why they leave, you know, lots of reasons. It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of a human heart, but they left. And now the company, because they have good employment counsel and good practices, they've preserved that employee's data, their email, their phone, their work-issued phones, laptops, and any other devices or assets, and they've looked through those things to see if there is any evidence of anything nefarious. So looking for sending files to themselves or communicating with a competitor or things like that. And the company has a decision point whether they want to enforce the non-compete. And that's something that sometimes companies don't think it's worth it, or sometimes it's very, very important. And so that's always an important decision for the company. And then the inevitable next step is that the company will start negotiation, usually through outside counsel, with the employee who has left, and oftentimes the new employer, the competitor. And that's a really important phase. And I think a fair number of these types of cases get resolved during that phase, and there are a lot of tools that employers have to try to move the ball towards settlement and to try to achieve what they need to. You want to talk about a couple of those?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. I would 100% agree that the vast majority of non-competes and competitive departures that we see do get resolved at this early stage, this negotiation stage, with either opposing counsel or the new employer. Some of the tools that we use regularly are, you know, sitting the employee out from a certain market or a certain client base or a certain geography, freezing them out from certain areas of the business. A really sort of creative opportunity sometimes is a temporary reassignment until a negotiated period on the restricted period for the non-compete expires. There's a lot. I mean, all the way up to the sort of the nuclear option, which is having the new employer withdraw the job offer and take away the employment from that employee.
So if, let's say that fails, then the employer often has a second chance to decide whether they want to invest the time and money to pursue the non-compete and try to enforce it. And again, even though some employers or companies have decided to try to enforce it initially, there's another time where they might say, this is going to cost a lot of money to start litigating, and do we really want to go down this path? But if they do, the next step is to file a lawsuit, and often part of that is seeking a temporary restraining order or a TRO. And if you've ever been through seeking a TRO, you certainly know what that entails, and it is a lot of kind of work on the front end. It's a very quick process. It can go as fast as within a few days to a week. You're quickly trying to gather enough information to effectively have a mini trial, where you have to have declarations from employees and provide enough evidence to the court to give the court comfort that there's both an enforceable agreement and that the employee or the former employee is violating it. And if you're successful in bringing that TRO, the court will temporarily block the employee from starting work or from doing a certain kind of work or for working with certain kinds of people, depending on kind of what you ask. And that will lead to a second phase, typically a month or sometimes a little bit more later, where the parties argue over a preliminary injunction, which is a slightly more permanent order from the court that the employee or the former employee has to stop doing or can't do something that the employer is asking. And again, that would stay in place then for the duration of the case until there is a trial or summary judgment or some subsequent final decision from the court. And usually what that looks like, assuming that there is still time left on the non-compete, is a permanent injunction. So that's the last order that the court will give that will finally say, yes, this employee cannot do these things or cannot work for this employer for the full duration of the non-compete or some time that's shorter than that. And so that's kind of the full life cycle. So let's talk about what the law was in the old world, which we're still in because we have until January 1st, 2020 before Washington's new law goes into effect. So prior to the new law, Washington addressed non-competes through the common law, which was a system of decisions and law developed by Washington courts, state courts, county superior courts, appellate courts, and Washington Supreme Court over the past 90 years or so. And the law in Washington generally followed the law in many of the states, which was that non-competes are enforceable as long as they're reasonable. And what reasonable means is the court looks at three different factors. The first is whether it was narrowly tailored to geography and duration. The second is whether it was necessary to protect a legitimate business interest. And the third was making sure there was no unreasonable harm to the public if the agreement is enforced. So what reasonable means in each of these categories is completely dependent on the facts. And so it was always, when you get one of these cases, you're looking for a case you can find that has the close enough facts, and then you kind of look to see what year range and what geographic limitations were acceptable in that format. And what is acceptable when you're talking about a physician who has a practice where all the patients come from within 10 miles is going to be very different from what's reasonable for someone who is a salesperson who has a global customer reach. So it's the geographic restrictions are really going to depend on what does that person's work look like, and really what is the legitimate business interest that is being protected. So what is a legitimate business interest? Once again, it's going to really depend on what your company does and what the person who is being subjected to the non-compete, what they do. The best and most likely to succeed protectable interest deals with confidential information or trade secrets or goodwill and business and customer relationships. And you can kind of fit those arguments into any of the situations that might arise, because that really is kind of a general a generally valuable and protectable interest of any company is going to be with their relationships with their customers, the way they do business, and their kind of confidential and trade secret information. Finally, it's important to keep in mind that as it will be after 2020, non-competes are currently only enforceable if they were validly formed. Now, what that means after January 1 is going to be different, as you're going to find out soon. But some of those concepts remain the same, and the biggest one is valid consideration. So consideration is a legal term that basically means if you have a contract and you sign it and it obligates you to do something, it's only enforceable if you get something in return. So one of these, where this plays out for the most part is when you give a existing employee a non-compete. As many of you probably know, the law in Washington and many states has been for a while now that you can't just have an existing employee sign a current non-compete. And you can't say, well, you get to keep your job, and in exchange, you're going to have this non-compete. Courts have said that that's not new consideration. They had their job at the start of that day, so you're not really giving them anything new, even though, you know, it sort of sounds like a little bit of a strong-arm tactic to say, well, you can keep your job. So that's an issue that companies have had to deal with now, even under the old law. So that's not going to be new under the new law. And the last piece that's kind of interesting under the existing law is that employees have to receive and sign their non-compete agreement. If they're new employees, they have to receive and sign it within maybe a week, at most two, after starting employment. Up until this new law, there was always that bit of a grace period where the courts said, really, employees should have this at the start of their employment so they know what they're getting into. But as long as they're getting it within the first week or so, or 2 weeks maybe, that's going to be fine, and we're not going to invalidate it just because of that. So that's some backdrop and kind of an overview of the way things worked. And we're going to talk a little bit more about some of these specific factors in the context of discussing the new law, because a lot of what we just covered isn't going to change after January 1st. So let's talk about the new law. Devin, easy question for you. Has anything changed in Washington non-compete law in the last year?
Well, there have been some changes. We thought it'd be helpful to go through really quickly what some of the motivation was from the Washington legislature on changes to the law. As some of you on the phone may know, the legislature here in the state has been interested in tightening restrictions on non-competes for several years. They've proposed bills in the last couple of sessions, and those have died in certain stages throughout the process. In 2019, they finally got it over the goal line. We don't really know what the great motivation was this year, but we do know that there has been some significant momentum from other states the last couple of years. I think probably most people on the phone are aware that California, for many years, has had a flat prohibition on non-competes in the state. They cannot be enforced in California with very few exceptions. One of the big inspirations, perhaps, for our legislature this year was Massachusetts. Last year, 2018, almost a year to the day, actually, Massachusetts passed a law that has many of the same requirements that the new Washington law has. So we are pretty confident that the Washington legislature borrowed heavily from the Massachusetts law. And some of those pieces include the advanced disclosure requirement, the independent consideration requirement, which has always been a piece of the common law, but it's now been codified, and pretty stringent restrictions on the restricted period. The thing to note on this slide is that, in particular, for folks on the phone who have a multi-state employment population or folks that have a nationwide business, if you do have employees in other states, this is a trend that will continue. We're very confident that we're going to see more and more state legislatures pick up the torch on the non-compete restrictions, and it'll become increasingly difficult for multi-state employers to comply in each of the jurisdictions where they operate.
So, like I mentioned a minute ago, some of the things under the new regime will be very different and they will have changed, but a lot of the fundamentals will stay the same. So let's start with what's going to stay the same.
Yeah, the things that will stay the same are going to be all of the concepts from the common law that, Matt discussed a second ago. You know, your non-compete still has to have a reasonable scope. It still needs to have, protecting a legitimate business interest. It needs to be narrowly tailored and validly formed. And courts will still go through each of those elements to make sure that the non-compete isn't overly onerous. But what the new law is doing is it's not displacing all that 90 years of common law. What it's really doing is adding a much more stringent set of requirements that'll make it more difficult to comply frankly, leave no room for error. It's a highly technical law with highly technical requirements, and any missteps in your application or enforcement of the non-compete will at some point, subject the employer to mandatory penalties and damages, but we'll get into that at the towards the end of the presentation.
Yeah, and the one thing that's nice is that because the meat of the law in Washington remains the same, that these non-competes have to be reasonable in scope and protect a legitimate business interest, all of the case law and experience that we've had over the past years before the statute will still apply, and courts who have been familiar with analyzing those decisions and the way that the law has formed over the years will be comfortable and conversant in that language. So really, with the new law, although it does have these kind of onerous technical requirements about how the agreement is formed, you can kind of focus on those and ticking off those boxes, knowing that what you've been doing for many years with non-competes in terms of whether this is an appropriate scope or whether this is reasonable to protect, that's really going to stay the same, and the courts are going to be comfortable with that analysis as it used to be. So, go ahead. Do you want to add something?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say let's get into the good stuff. This is, I think, what everybody's been waiting for. This is the new world. We're about to jump in, and Matt's going to describe some of these significant changes that are appearing for the first time in the statute.
Right. So, as you all know, January 1st, 2020. The new law goes into effect. It's just recently, maybe in the last few days, appeared in the RCWs. You can find it online, 49.62. And it does significantly change the non-compete landscape, both in terms of codifying and slightly changing the substantive requirements, and also having a significant number of technical or procedural requirements. So let's go through what those major changes are. The first one is that it requires advanced disclosure in writing. And we're going to go through each of these in a little more detail. But basically, you have to give the non-compete in writing or tell the employee about the terms of the non-compete before or at the time they accept the job offer. And that's a problem under for a lot of practices, because companies or employers often give these agreements kind of day one or in the first week after the employee starts. The second big change is that the law says that courts and arbitrators shall consider any non-compete period that is for over 18 months post-termination to be unreasonable and unenforceable. It's a presumption against the employer or the company trying to enforce, and it can only be overcome by using clear and convincing evidence that the business interest at issue is sufficiently serious and protectable that it justifies going beyond that 18-month period. In-house, we've always kind of, in the last year or 2 years, noting the trend, especially advised that unless you have something special to protect, and that's often the case, that 2 years or less was really what you wanted to aim for. But there was a lot less of a concern because under the new law, or under the old law, you could always edit the agreement, or a court could always edit the agreement, and it was effectively no harm, no foul. But that's no longer the case, as we're going to get to. So the next big change is there are dollar thresholds. You cannot enforce a non-compete against an employee making less than $100,000 annually, and you cannot enforce a non-compete against an independent contractor that is paid less than $250,000 per year. And the law specifically accounts for inflation and has a process for increasing those dollar amounts every year. The big hammer in the new law is that any party that has to sue to avoid enforcement of a non-compete that is not enforceable gets their attorney's fees, and they get costs and either actual damages or a $5,000 penalty. And again, there's a lot we're going to kind of get into and break that down in a little bit. And finally, the other big change that is causing lots of consternation among clients is that this law is probably retroactive. In other words, if you have covenants not to compete that were entered into before January 1, 2020, but are not enforceable under the new law, then they're not going to be enforceable after January 1, 2020, and the penalties and attorney's fees might still apply.
Okay, well, as Matt mentioned, we're going to go through each of these changes, these statutory changes, in a little more detail. The advanced disclosure requirement in the statute, this is the major procedural requirement in the law. What it says is that non-competes are, quote, void and unenforceable unless the employer discloses the terms of the non-compete, it should say in writing, no later than the time of the acceptance of the offer of employment. So the best practice, and there are some tweaks that employers can use here, but the absolute best practice, the gold standard for folks here, is to disclose the non-compete at the time of the offer. After January 1st, 2020, disclosing the non-compete at the time of the offer it will be advantageous because it'll create a record of sending the non-compete terms to the employee, which is great if it's ever challenged. And it will be what we hope is an unimpeachable defense for the employer if they ever have to get into court or argue or defend against an allegation that the non-compete wasn't provided before the employee accepted the offer of employment. As you can see, and we'll say this repeatedly as we get into the weeds on each of these statutory requirements, but there are going to be significant unknowns about each of these items. The way that the statute is phrased on the advanced disclosure requirement, it says specifically the terms of the non-compete have to be disclosed to the employee before the acceptance of the offer of employment. You know, I think most people on the phone are aware, you know, non-competes aren't just offered at the commencement of employment. They're from time to time, issued to employees throughout employment or even at the end of employment. And the statute offers absolutely no guidance on how to handle those situations. So, it's possible that for a current employee, for example, who you want to update your non-compete or issue a new non-compete to, you know, if you're tying the non-compete to, let's say, a promotion, you could see how that would dovetail with the language in the statute, and you could offer the non-compete to them, the terms of the non-compete in writing before they accept the promotion. That would probably fly under the new statute. It's less clear whether, as employers in Washington have done for decades, if they've wanted to roll out a new non-compete or a new employment agreement. Sometimes they'll offer a cash bonus or something of value. It's less clear to us whether that'll dovetail and harmonize with the statute. So we just wanted to flag that as something that's unclear with the new language.
So next, let's talk about the 18-month restricted period. As I mentioned, there's a presumption baked into the new law that 18 months is unreasonable and unenforceable. The presumption can be rebutted, as I mentioned, with clear and convincing evidence that more than 18 months is necessary to protect the party's business or goodwill, and so that's getting to that protectable interest. And it's long been the case that the stronger your protectable interest was, the more likely that you were going to be able to have a longer term on your non-compete. So, for example, if you're in an industry where customer relationships are incredibly important, and that it's not a very fast-changing industry, so not necessarily like a tech field. You're going to have a much stronger basis to assert a non-compete for a longer period of time against someone who was really up to their elbows in those relationships and developing them and developing goodwill on behalf of the company. So what we have to say, though, is that Washington courts are very skeptical of non-competes. The trend hasn't just been in the legislatures in the last 2 years, but it's been in the courts for the last 5-6 years, particularly as the tech industry has proliferated, and where some of the larger voices in the tech industry have come out against non-competes, and there's been a kind of political and social pushback on those types of agreements. So our advice on what is reasonable time length to our clients has sort of gotten shorter and shorter over the years, and that's been reflected as well in the decisions that have come out. Which isn't to say that you won't still have a 3-year non-compete enforced, so provided there is a really important interest. But the safest bet is to use that 18-month benchmark and really pressure test any desire or idea to include a longer term to make sure you're comfortable with being able to explain by clear and convincing evidence, sort of specific evidence, why you need it here, not just that, you know, our business is really important and that kind of generalities. The one thing that we want to call out here is that the 18-month restricted period probably doesn't apply when you sell a business. Like Devin mentioned, there are lots of scenarios where non-competes are used, and one of those is the sale of a business. That's always been looked upon differently than a non-compete in another context. In fact, even California allows for non-competes in the sale of a business. And so the new law has a provision saying that it does not apply to covenants entered as part of the sale of a business. And so, you know, not only do you have that exception, but it's always been, you know, even under the existing law, that courts were far more likely to say, hey, you got a big piece of, you sold this goodwill, you sold this business, or you acquired, you know, shares and then sold them. And so, you know, you're really getting a lot that needs to be protected here.
Okay. One of the other requirements in the statute is, as Matt mentioned earlier, the earnings for both independent contractors and for employees. The statute is fairly clear that the non-compete is void and unenforceable unless an employee's annualized earnings exceed, that is greater than, $100,000 per year. And the legislature actually went to great lengths to define what earnings are in the definition section of the statute. For an employee, the earnings are, it's the number, the compensation reflected in their W-2 statement. And what that means, as far as we can tell, is that equity would not be included in that, stock options, things like that. It would just be cash money to the employee that appears in box one of their W-2 form. For independent contractors, the legislature was a little more stringent. They have said that the earnings minimum to enforce a non-compete against an independent contractor is $250,000 per year. Oddly enough, the language about annualized earnings for employees does not appear in the independent contractor section. And I think as folks are aware, that it'll be interesting to see how a court interprets that omission. There's a statutory construction principle that suggests that when a bill or a statute uses language in one section and doesn't use it in a similar section, it suggests that it was intentional. So it'll be interesting to see how that's applied. very important to note that these amounts, the $100,000 for employees and the $250,000 for independent contractors, those amounts will increase automatically every year with inflation, which is usually about 1-2% a year. So, you know, the amount that applies on, you know, January 1st, 2020, will go up, will grow every year after that. down at the bottom of the slide, a practice tip for folks here. The legislature did they did consider the possibility that an employee could be hired at less than $100,000 a year, but through the course of their employment would end up making more than $100,000 a year by the time the employer sought to enforce the non-compete. The trick on that is, you know, the statute specifically allows employers to enforce a non-compete in that scenario, but there has to be these magic words, this magic language that has to be included in the non-compete covenant that flags this for the employee so that they're walking into that arrangement eyes wide open. So it's pretty clear, as you can see, as we start to march through some of these specifics, that there are lots of traps for the unwary here. It's easy to inadvertently not comply with this new law. Penalties. This is where the, as Matt said, the big hammer comes in. This is the stick in the statute. After January 1st, 2020, you know, that's when the rubber really is going to hit the road on the penalties. Another way of saying that is you can still sort of mess up your non-competes until, you know, December 31st of this year without really creating significant exposure for the company. But after January 1st, 2020, there's no more amnesty in the law. So non-compliant non-competes after, again, January 1st, 2020, will result in mandatory penalties and fines and costs and fees for non-compliant non-competes. And we'll just walk through some of those in greater detail here. The way that the statute is framed, there is a, like we say, a mandatory $5,000 penalty or actual damages, whichever is greater, plus attorney's fees and costs for when a non-compete provision violates the chapter. There in the statute, we've looked over it with a fine-tooth comb. There does not appear to be any carve-out or exclusion. So the way that it's worded, it applies with equal force to procedural violations as it does to substantive violations. There's no exceptions or carve-outs. The trick on this one, too, and Matt alluded to this earlier, is that a violation of the chapter also includes a scenario where the arbitrator or a court modifies the non-compete. So in the old world, a lot of times employers would have fairly aggressive non-competes that had a two-year restricted period or longer with the idea that they could go into a court, seek to enforce the non-compete, and the general principles of blue penciling in Washington would apply, where the court or the arbitrator would take that two-year non-compete and say, well, you know, that's really onerous, that's not fair, that's just impeding somebody's ability to make a living. We're just gonna take that and shave it down to 18 months or 12 months to make it fair. And there was no penalty for doing that. It was a function of what the courts would do, and a lot of times in these processes, if a court now has to do that, has to shave it down, it'll result in these mandatory penalties and costs and fees for the employer. So it's really important to get it right the first time.
So I see some questions coming in, and that's great. What we're gonna do is when we see questions that we're planning on answering in the next few slides or so or later in the presentation, we're going to hold off on those. But please keep them coming, and we're definitely going to try to address as many as we can. So another really important question is whether this law is retroactive. Does it mean that after January 1, will employers get in trouble for actions they took back in 2017 or 2016 when their agreements were perfectly enforceable and valid? And I'm happy to share that we don't know the answer. And in fact, no one really does. The law is again, not very clear, and it's slightly, it's looking like it's probably retroactive. The law says that employers can, there's an amnesty provision that says if you don't try to enforce an old agreement, in other words, if you have a pre-January 1, 2020 non-compete that doesn't comply with the new law, if you don't try to enforce it, the employee cannot sue you for violating the agreement. So that amnesty provision suggests that the law is retroactive, and you really can't do anything with your old agreement. One of the questions we received was, were the penalties that Devin just mentioned, are those only applied or are they applicable at the time the non-compete is enforced? And the answer is sometimes. If you have a old non-compete, one that was pre-January 1, 2020, the amnesty provision suggests that you won't get hit with a penalty as long as you don't try to enforce it. That's the easiest reading of what that says. However, what the law does, you know, also makes clear is that if you, after January 1, 2020, after the law is in effect, enter a new non-compete that does not comply with the law, then the employee could sue you at any time and enforce and say, you're violating the law. You had me enter this agreement and it's illegal. And even though I might still be a current employee with no plans to leave, you violate this law, and courts will find that you owe the $5,000 penalty or actual damages plus the attorney's fees and costs. And as most of you, I'm sure, are aware, it's really that latter fees and costs that will drive this litigation, and particularly what I think might be a lot of potential class actions. Devin, I know you do a lot of class actions. Can you maybe just take a minute and talk about what that might look like?
Yeah. Thanks, Matt. I'm sure many of you are familiar with how class actions operate in the state and the requirements that are necessary under Rule 23 to maintain a class action lawsuit. This statute, in many ways, seems like it's perfectly tailored to fit into that Rule 23 class action framework. You can very easily envision a scenario where an employer, maybe a major employer in the state, didn't get the memo about the changes that are coming January 1st, 2020, and they roll out non-compliant non-competes to, let's say, 100 employees, right after in their hiring spree and at the start of 2020. Again, because there's no amnesty provision for non-competes that are entered into after January 1, 2020, it's possible, and again, if the retroactivity provision doesn't kick in, it is possible that all 100 of those non-competes would be certified as a class and would subject the employer to upwards of $500,000 in damages plus the costs and fees.
Something to avoid.
Something to avoid. Yeah, that's why we're trying to get everybody on the same page about the non-competes. We are very confident that there will be some guinea pigs. There will be some folks that do get hit at the beginning of 2020 or soon thereafter, and it'll be at that point where, with the publicity and all of the visibility into those lawsuits, we think is when folks will really start to get on board. But you guys, everybody on the phone now is already ahead of the curve, so that's great.
Let's talk about those sweet, sweet loopholes.
There are some good loopholes. It's not all bad news. There is some good news here in the statute. It's not a lot of good news, but there's some. I'm going to repeat these a couple of times just so it really sinks in. The statute really focuses on non-competition covenants. It specifically excludes non-solicitation, confidentiality, invention, and trade secret provisions. Again, those are all explicitly excluded in the statute. They don't apply. You can 100% keep your current non-solicits, confidentiality, trade secret agreements.
Could you maybe just explain the difference between a non-solicitation and a non-compete?
Sure, yeah. The non-competition covenant is the requirement that says that you can't go work for a competitor, another company that does pretty much exactly the same thing that your current employer does. A non-solicit, and there's two buckets in the non-solicit world. One is the non-solicitation of employees, current employees that work for your old employer, and the non-solicitation of customers. And both of those are viewed and enforced fairly regularly by the courts. So again, we're actually seeing some clients who have taken a sort of a creative look at their covenants and their employment agreements, and they've said, you know, look, do we really need our non-compete? What we really want to protect here is our customer relationships and our confidential information. Maybe we don't need the non-compete at all. So they're starting to double down on the non-solicits and the confidentiality and the trade secrets protections, and scaling back a little bit on the non-competes in light of the new statute. The next piece here is it's more of a requirement, actually, in the statute that we didn't mention before. We put it in the loophole section because some of our clients have tried to get creative and make their own loophole around this requirement. But the new statute, what it does is it requires that venue and choice of law both are Washington-based. So, you know, there's a provision that says any attempt to deprive the holder of the non-compete of the protections of the statute will void and make the non-compete unenforceable. So we've had a couple of clients that have very creatively said, hey, look, I'm a Florida corporation, or I'm a Utah corporation. My headquarters are here. My principal place of business is here. Most of my employees are here in Florida or Utah. You know, are you telling me that if I put a Utah venue and choice of law provision into my non-compete, and I, you know, when the employee leaves and breaches, if I race to the courthouse in Florida or Utah, my own backyard, and try to enforce it, are you telling me that they're going to take this Washington statute from across the country and enforce it? And under normal circumstances, you know, that might be an okay approach to take. The problem here is that I think the Washington legislature was anticipating that, and they've created a requirement in the statute that says that the employee can bring a declaratory action in Washington for any non-compliant non-compete. So the race to the courthouse is one that you would probably lose, is the problem, because the employee, especially if they thought that they were going to leave employment, they would race to the courthouse here in Washington, file the declaratory action, and seek their costs and fees. The independent consideration piece, we've gone over that before. If you're a current employee and the employer seeks to implement a new non-compete, a compliant non-compete, independent consideration is required there. The good news on that is that we think that it's solidifying this ability for employers to implement new non-competes for current employees and making that process a little more streamlined for folks. And as Matt mentioned before, non-compete, this is the last bullet. A non-compete is okay as part of a business transaction, and the is, again, expressly excluded from the statute if it's part of a business transaction. So the requirements, the procedural and substantive requirements, would not apply.
So we're going to take a quick detour here and talk about a somewhat standout provision in the law, which is an anti-moonlighting provision. Moonlighting, as you probably all know, is the ability of an employee to go get a second job somewhere else. And the legislature here, they snuck this provision into the law, even though it's not really a non-compete per se, but it has a similar flavor. So the requirements are very different. So first of all, what it says is that if the employee earns less than twice minimum wage, which if you go by January 1, 2020, is $55,000. So if an employee makes less than $55,000, you can't have a policy or any kind of agreement that prevents them from supplementing their income by working somewhere else, whether that's as an independent contractor or even being self-employed. And the key here is that there are exceptions, and there are very common sense exceptions, which is that if it's a safety issue, so let's say you're driving trucks and you're trying to work another job that has you get no sleep, scheduling issues, obviously an employer doesn't have to work around the schedules of their employees, other employers, duty of loyalty, if they're doing, it's effectively competing, working for a competitor, doing the same kind of thing in a way that's going to violate that duty. Same with conflicts of interest, particularly where public employment is involved or federal contractors or public contractors are involved. And so if you do have a provision that prohibits moonlighting, you're going to want to take another look at that as well. A lot of companies do have those. and just make sure that it's only going to apply to the right people, and that if it's not, that you're going to have your exceptions kind of figured out and lined up. So what we'd like to do now is talk about a couple scenarios that are going to sort of show us how we think through and spot some of the issues that will arise both now and thinking about the future and after the new law goes into effect. So the first scenario is that we're going to use ACME, the company, and Anne, an employee, signed ACME's standard employment agreement in 2015 on her first day of work. It contains a non-compete that prevents her from working for a competitor for 24 months after employment. She's always made over $100,000 per year. So, Devin, question. Is the non-compete valid after January 1, and what should ACME do?
Yeah, right. We packed a lot into this very short scenario here, and the idea is what we wanted to do is we wanted to take a lot of the questions that we were getting and have already received from current clients and sort of pack them into these scenarios. And what we're going to do is we're just going to issue spot through these. The first one, and I think most of you guys probably caught this one, is that, you know, she signed the agreement on her first day of work. This is the procedural issue that we talked about at the beginning. You know, the interesting is a little bit of a trick question in here, because it says that she signed the agreement on her first day of work. You know, as you guys know, you know, if the terms were disclosed to her before she accepted, that might be okay. You know, the big issue there is whether it was signed or disclosed to her. And I think what the legislature is getting at there is, you know, they're trying to avoid contracts of adhesion. So as long as you could show that the terms of the non-compete were provided in writing in advance of her signing it on her first day and accepting on that day, I think that you'd be actually in pretty good shape on that one. The 24 months, that's obviously going to be an issue with the 18-month presumed period, restricted period. You know, it's possible, again, that for some extraordinary circumstance and for the need to protect a business interest that you could go beyond the 18 months. We are not confident that that is something that we will see regularly, if ever, in the state. But it's something to keep in mind that it's only a presumption and it can be rebutted with clear and convincing evidence. The scope, of course, will always have to be reasonable based on the common law. Here it says that, you know, she was prevented from working for a competitor. I think it would be important to know how a competitor was defined in the agreement. And the over $100,000 a year, that seems fine. If she's an employee, again, if she's making more than $100,000 a year in the W-2 box, that should be no problem. If she's an independent contractor or has a large stake of equity, that would be a different story.
So it sounds like this, you would have concerns about this agreement being enforceable given the 24-month period. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, there's just a lot of moving parts on these. There's a lot of booby traps, and you just have to go through and make sure that you're checking all the boxes that you need to check on these.
So is part of the advice to ACME that it should consider whether or not it needs to or wants to get a new non-compete?
Yeah, I think especially with the 24-month restricted period, I think that they'd probably want to take a look at it and go through the language, the specific context, and frankly, their process on how they roll these out.
Okay, and we're going to finish our scenarios, and then we're going to talk a lot about, I think, what to do with a current employee who has a non-compete that will become unenforceable after January 1. And we're getting that question, so just hold tight for that for a moment. But first, let's go to the second scenario. So sticking with ACME, Sean received a standard employment agreement along with his offer letter. So that sounds good, right? The agreement contains a non-compete preventing him from working for a competitor for 12 months after employment. But he was hired at less than $100,000 per year, even though now he makes more than $100,000. So is the non-compete valid in 2020, and what should ACME do?
Yeah, so this one, what we were trying to do here is create a dichotomy between the first one, which had some problems, and the second one, which had less problems. The disclosure, the pre-acceptance disclosure of the non-compete actually looks okay on this one. It's the gold standard, right, when you send the terms of the non-compete in writing before the acceptance, so that looks okay. The 12 months looks fine, too. I don't think a court would frown upon the 12 months in particular because of the 18-month presumed restricted period. In fact, a lot of our clients have been implementing 12-month non-competes for the last couple of years or decades even, and a lot of them, when they saw the 18-month presumed restricted period in the statute, they saw it as sort of a gift horse, you know, because they said, wow, the legislature just gave me permission to add another 6 months onto my restricted period. You know, and the last thing I would flag on this is that, you know, look, he was hired at less than $100,000 per year, but now he makes more. So, you know, the non-compete would have to contain that magic language that I was talking about earlier in the presentation for it to be enforceable against the employee.
So if even though got it at the time of employment, the offer, making enough money, the period is reasonable, even though all that's true, the agreement wouldn't be enforceable?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, unless the terms of the agreement contain that language that notified him that it could be enforceable in the future after he crosses the minimum earnings threshold, it would not be enforceable.
And do you have standard language that you've drafted that you're
trying? I do. I've come up with some very brilliant language that I've been sharing with people.
Quick plug. Okay, so let's go to the next scenario. I think you got one for me.
Yep. So Jeff, who has never earned more than $90,000 per year, signed a severance agreement containing a 12-month non-compete. Does Jeff still get the severance, and what should ACME do?
So obvious problems here. If it were a non-compete tied to the beginning of employment, he didn't sign it. Well, actually, it's unclear when he signed it, but the bigger problem there, obviously, is that he's earning only $90,000 per year. That's less than the $100,000 threshold. So under the new law, that won't be enforceable, and the problem that arises that we've gotten questions about from clients is, well, Jeff's still going to think that he's entitled to a 12-month severance or the 6-month severance, whatever it was. And so what do we, the company, do at this point? And the answer to that is you're going to have to look really closely at the severance agreement itself. Severance agreements, as many of you are probably aware, can kind of fall into two buckets. One is courts will consider them, the severance payment, to be wages, which are earned by the employee's service to the company. Those wages are treated the same as any other wage under Washington law. And so if you don't pay it, you withhold it, that's going to be subject you to the same penalties as if you would withheld a paycheck. On the other hand, severance agreements can make that non-compete expressly tied to the severance payment. And so the cleanest example would be if the severance agreement is short and sweet and it says, we are paying you this severance agreement solely and exclusively in exchange for your agreement not to go and work for a competitor for 6 months or for a year or whatever it is. And if you have that kind of standalone this for that exchange, you have a good argument under basic contract law that your contract is void because the employee is no longer obligated to do anything through no fault of your own. If there's just been a change in the law, and now you, the employer, cannot get what you bargained for, and so it is only fair that the employee also cannot get what they bargained for. However, this is a highly dependent argument on what the contracts look like and how the sequence of events played out. And Washington courts are fairly skeptical of severance payments in terms of they like to consider them to be wage payments. So what do you do in this situation? What you're going to have to do is the same thing you're going to have to do in any situation where your agreement is unenforceable. You're going to have to evaluate just how strong your arguments are and whether you want to wait to make those arguments to the extent that Jeff seeks to enforce his severance, or whether you want to approach the employee now and say, look, we have a problem. We struck this deal that was good for everybody, and now it's not going to be good for anybody, and so we need to redo it. And we're going to get to that in just a minute.
Yeah, and the only other footnote that I would add on this one is that the statute has a requirement when an employee is laid off as part of a quote-unquote a layoff, which is not defined in the statute, if you want to enforce a non-compete, it does require payment of a garden leave. So that's just something to keep in mind in that scenario. If it seems like something is going to qualify for that layoff scenario, which, again, is not defined in the statute, if you do want to enforce the non-compete, you're going to have to pay garden leave to the employee. All right, and the last scenario that we've got today is after starting work, Janine entered a stock grant agreement with ACME that includes 12-month non-compete. What happens with that?
Well, again, we don't have the information here, but let's assume she was making less than $100,000, or that this stock agreement, it says it was entered after she started work. So you're going to have a problem enforcing this non-compete because of those procedural requirements. One of the things that you're going to always want to look at is whether the stock grant agreement will get Janine into this bucket of employees whose non-competes are enforceable because it's part of the sale of the business. And where that line is going to be highly dependent on the business, the type of business, the amount of equity that exists in the universe versus what Janine got. So there's going to be a lot of facts you're going to have to look at. If you're getting, 10 shares of a massive publicly traded company, that's probably not going to fall into this. Well, you're selling the goodwill of the company when you dispose of those shares or anything like that. So this is, we're just wanted to flag this issue that when you do have a non-compete tied to one of these stock grant agreements, or for that matter, a severance agreement, or anything else that's not a standard welcome to the workplace, here's our agreement situation, that you're going to want to kind of look at some of these different possible exceptions and be mindful of other like contractual arguments and things like that. So we have a few minutes left, which is just in time to get to our strategies. So what do we do with current employees, especially those who you want to offer new non-competes to?
Yeah, and again, stressing on this slide that we're talking about current employees, right, who are subject to what is very likely a non-compliant non-compete. What do you do with those folks, which is a huge percentage of the workers in the state right now? So you basically have three choices, and these are very broad strokes, but there's three main buckets of strategy that you can take on this. The first is, you can affirmatively update your non-compliant non-competes. Second thing that you can do is you can disclaim your non-compliant non-competes, basically say, we're not going to seek to enforce these. Everybody gets a get-out-of-jail-free card on these. We're not going to seek to enforce them. And the third thing that companies can do is basically do nothing with the old agreements. In our experience so far working with clients, most of our clients have wanted to update the non-compliant non-compete. I'd say the vast majority.
Especially now when this hasn't, like you mentioned earlier, hit the press and, right, and become a thing where employees are going to understand more about what's at stake.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, even just thinking about it for a couple of seconds, there's a lot of challenges with rolling out compliant non-competes. Again, the independent consideration has been a sticking point for a lot of clients. How do you roll that out? Do you do a rolling basis for certain employees where, when they get a promotion or, a special bonus, something like that that's happening as a part of their performance, whether you roll it out on that basis or whether you do what we're calling sort of a one-time shot, where you roll it out on a massive scale comprehensively to all your employees and you offer instead of, on this rolling basis as things turn out for each employee, if you do it on this one-time shot and roll it out with, let's say, $1,000 or $2,000 cash bonus to each employee for the independent consideration. It's really been a case-by-case assessment. Some clients have wanted to go one way, some clients have wanted to go the other. The only thing to keep in mind is that, whichever route that you decide to go, the independent consideration has to have value that the employee is not otherwise entitled to. So, like I say, cash payment, promotion, even, I worked with a client recently that wanted to give out a gift card, which I thought was great. But the thing is, the value of the consideration has to be sufficient enough to both pass legal muster, which isn't really that high, it could probably be just a couple hundred dollars, but it's more important that it incentivizes the employee to actually accept.
And just one quick point, and we had a question about, do you need to affirmatively disclaim your non-competes? Well, I think that if you aren't going to try to enforce them because they're unenforceable, I think it's a good idea to affirmatively disclaim them, and here's why. I don't think that you gain much by staying quiet, other than possibly employees thinking their non-competes might be enforceable and thereby staying at your place of work longer because they're afraid they can't leave. Setting aside, that's probably not the best way to retain employees. That puts you at risk, I think, of potential class action. And I think the argument would be by plaintiffs that you are using these agreements to keep people frozen in place. Even though you can't enforce them, they don't know that. And so by just having them, you're creating harm. So just a quick note there that I think disclaiming is a good idea if you're not going to try to replace.
Yeah, and the other thing that we've seen employers struggle with is how hard a line to take on the requirement that all new that all employees sign new non-competes. And, you know, the only thing that we've said there, that's a business decision that every client has to make. But if you're going to say it's a legitimate condition of employment and you have to sign the new non-compete, you have to be willing to take action consistently across your employee population if they don't.
Okay, so I know we're at 11, and here's our last slide, and this is strategies for current we had a wait-and-see approach. So this is basically what Devin just covered. We missed a slide here. But future employees, and this is a pretty easy one, make sure your non-competes after January 1 comply with the law. So like Devin said, there's no room for error. You will get hit with either declaratory class actions, even if you don't even try to enforce this, even possibly if you don't have employees leaving the competitors and testing it out. That's a big class action risk, and class actions are on the rise, as many of you probably know. And, you know, keep in mind that you don't have a chance to modify or partially enforce a non-compete. So consider, you know, if you're risk-averse, consider going with the non-solicit and confidentiality agreements and working for creative ways of just avoiding these obligations and this law entirely. So we appreciate you staying a little bit long with us. We're just a touch over the hour. It's been a pleasure to talk about this, and to the extent you all have questions, please do feel free to reach out to Devin and me. We love this topic. We love thinking through these things, and we'd love to hear what you all are thinking and what you're working on. So thank you again for your time today.
Thank you. A link to the online program evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.